Ukrainian people are demonstrating by their physical courage that they are not about to just let Putin take what he wants. That's clear. They'll defend their freedom, their democracy, their lives. And we're going to keep providing security assistance, economic assistance, and humanitarian assistance. We're going to support them against tyranny, oppression, violent acts of subjugation. People everywhere, and I think it's maybe even surprised some of you all, people everywhere are speaking up for freedom. When the history of this war is written, Putin's war on Ukraine will have left Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger.
President Biden today, after announcing a ban on all U.S. imports of Russian oil and natural gas. The United Kingdom also announced plans today to ban Russian oil imports, phasing them out over the rest of the year. And the European Union, which is far more dependent on Russian fuel than we are, says it might cut Russian gas imports by two-thirds this year. All this represents the biggest financial threat to Russia's economy yet. Of course, there are big risks to the global economy. Oil prices are high. We can see that as gas prices rise here at home. The new sanctions also risk escalating Russia's war in Ukraine into a bigger conflict. Over the weekend, Russian President Vladimir Putin described the Western sanctions as, quote, akin to a declaration of war. Russia has around 6,000 nuclear weapons, the largest stockpile in the world. And as the war drags into its second week, with Russia failing to make significant advances, the possibility he may use nuclear weapons has increased. Joining us to talk about this is J.D. Williams, senior defense researcher at the policy think tank RAND. Welcome to Press Play.
Glad to join you, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, first, what do these oil sanctions mean for Russia's economy, and what could that possibly mean for Vladimir Putin's calculus when it comes to waging this war?
I'm not an economic expert, but as you noted, Russia is heavily dependent economically on its export of oil and gas. And so the economic hardships and the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia already are having an effect, and this is just going to exacerbate that. And what it could do, as you, again, you noted in your introduction with President Putin, is kind of add to his grievances or his hostility towards what he thinks is, or what he's seeing as the West's intervention in his conflict, which potentially makes the situation more dangerous than it already is.
He has put his nuclear arsenal into high alert. What does that mean exactly?
So that can mean several things. Both the U.S. and the Russia maintains a certain small portion of its nuclear arsenal on some kind of alert, just in case. It could mean moving more actual nuclear forces into that state, deploying more missiles to the field, sending submarines out. At least according to Department of Defense reporting, they're not seeing that happen yet. More likely, he's increasing some of his command and control systems, maybe manning command posts and testing the systems that would be used to control the nuclear weapons. But in my view, it's really more of a message that he's sending as opposed to the actual actions that he's carrying out. I think it was really a warning shot, if you will, when Putin kind of put that message out.
But given the fact that he hasn't been able to quickly take over Ukraine, at least perhaps not as quickly as he imagined, the military has been bogged down in this land war. Do you think he's more seriously considering using at least a tactical nuclear weapon that can be used just in Ukraine?
So I don't think we are there yet, but it is certainly disconcerting that we actually, for the first time since really the end of the Cold War, we actually have to consider the possibility that should conditions deteriorate, should his military not be able to achieve objectives, or should there be some kind of miscalculation or misperception of what other countries are doing in support of Ukraine, there is, at least at this point, some small possibility, and depending on how events evolve, that possibility could grow.
What would that look like? Like, what are people gaming out as possibilities if he did use a nuclear weapon in Ukraine?
Right. There are a variety of scenarios that, you know, have been, you know, looked at in war games. And if you look in Russian military doctrine and writing, the Russians are more loose, or their writings, you know, entertain the idea of using nuclear weapons more quickly in a conflict than, say, the U.S. would. This is especially since the end of the Cold War, where they've kind of, you know, adopted nuclear weapons, particularly battlefield nuclear weapons, as a way to compensate for their perceived and very real, in some cases, military deficiencies. So some of the scenarios that are considered would be a demonstration where they would set a nuclear weapon off. Could be somewhere in a territory of Russia, could be somewhere, you know, away from a population, you know, crossing a nuclear threshold, but not necessarily causing significant amount of damage. You know, a second possibility would be a very limited and what we call tactical, which would have a very specific purpose on to achieve some type of battlefield impact, a relatively, and I don't say this lightly because obviously any nuclear weapon is catastrophic, but a relatively low yield weapon that would be intended to limit the effects, and yet still, you know, make that point that Russia is willing to cross this threshold in order to achieve its objectives. I do not think we're talking about, at least initially, any kind of widespread or strategic engagement, you know, kinds of things where you think about Armageddon and attacks on homelands and things like that.
Or targeting Kiev, for example. It would flattening Kiev
that's not in his, you know, political, military, you know, propaganda interests. If there was a population center, it would likely be a small population center, you know, somewhere off the side. But we're crossing into some unknown territory here. Just the idea of taking on this invasion at all, Putin has clearly broken some norms and gone into an area again in Europe with, you know, major interstate conflict that we haven't been in for, you know, since the 1940s. Unfortunately, I don't think we can be too firm in predictions of how things might be limited.
How would you compare what's happening here and now with what Russia did in Chechnya and how it just went all out and really devastated that territory and also the city of Grozny?
Right. There are some likely parallels between what happened in Chechnya and what happened in Ukraine. The Russians went into Chechnya thinking that a small show of force would get the Chechens to knuckle under, and it didn't, and they had to pull back and then engage in basically urban conflict, which involved, you know, very, very heavy damage of the population centers. I don't think that's what they want to do with Ukraine. There was an ethnic element to the Chechen conflict that made it particularly vicious. I don't think they want to do that in Ukraine, but that appears to be the direction that this could be going, simply because their military can't accomplish the political objectives.
Right. And they're reportedly recruiting Syrian mercenaries to help in urban combat.
Yeah, and they've actually brought some Chechens in, so it's a recognition that, you know, there are some other forces that have special skill sets for fighting in the urban area and fighting counterinsurgency, and the Russians aren't afraid to, you know, bring them into the picture if it can help them.
We've seen the Ukrainian forces really surprisingly mount a strong defense against the much more heavily armed Russian forces. Do you think that the Ukrainian forces can actually win this war?
It would depend on what you define as winning. I mean, right now, the Ukrainians are winning by delaying and frustrating the Russian objectives. And the longer that continues, and there, you know, there is some possibility and some capacity for the Ukrainians to do that, the better the outlook is. But if Putin and Russia are willing to put their resources into this, it's going to be very difficult for the Ukrainians to hold the major population centers in the eastern part of the country without, you know, they were still resisting, but it'd go over to more of a kind of insurgency type of resistance.
J.D. Williams, senior defense researcher at RAND. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just days after Russia invaded Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky called on the United Nations to expel Russia from the Security Council. Members of Congress echoed that sentiment. Some even introduced a resolution urging the UN to kick Russia off, like Tennessee Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn.
What we have to do is make certain that the members that are there on the Security Council realize that the U.S. Senate is saying Russia does not deserve to be here because they're carrying out war crimes against Ukraine. They are killing innocent men and women and children.
It is not the United States' decision to make, though. In fact, the only way to remove Russia from the UN Security Council would be if Russia agreed to it, which seems unlikely. We're going to talk about all this now with Irena Zavaruka. She's an adjunct law professor at Southwestern Law School here in Los Angeles, where she focuses on international criminal law. She's also Ukrainian and a former dean at the Law School of Ukraine's National University in her hometown of Lviv. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
So the UN Security Council is designed to secure the peace, right?
Exactly.
And these five permanent members, the U.S., the U.K., France, China, and Russia, because they won World War II, they get a permanent seat on the Security Council, and they are supposed to guarantee world peace. Of course, that hasn't happened since the U.N. was founded. There hasn't been world peace at all. But this situation seems to be in Ukraine particularly acute right now, and focusing on that mission and focusing on who is designated to carry out that mission to secure international peace. Russia, by invading a sovereign nation, doesn't seem to be abiding by that principle. Is that reason enough to be able to kick Russia off the Security Council?
There is nothing in the UN Charter that would be designed to do anything against a permanent member of the Security Council or to do anything without the agreement or approval of the permanent member of the Security Council. So there is no mechanism that would allow doing that. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't talk about it.
But given what you just said and the fact that any member of the Security Council can veto a resolution, and in fact the United States does that all the time, particularly when it comes to Israel, then Russia could obviously veto any move by the Security Council to remove it from the Security Council. So is it just an academic argument?
Well, this is academic argument, and it's even more inspirational to start the conversation and to put the pressure on the General Assembly, because the United Nations is not only Security Council. The General Assembly can take over in the most critical situations, as it did a couple of days ago, reacting to the Russian aggression and Russian war in Ukraine.
Well, I think a lot of people look at the United Nations, not just the Security Council, but also the General Assembly, as issuing a lot of stark warnings and resolutions and not really having an effect. It seems like a pretty toothless organization, I think, to the lay observer. Do you think that's accurate?
It is accurate. The resolutions of the General Assembly are not binding. And that's a big problem because the time for condemnations is long gone. And General Assembly needs to step in because the Security Council is not moving on. That's the only forum in the world that whose mission is maintenance of international peace and security. There is no alternative to it.
What could the United Nations do? What would you want it to do?
The United Nations can authorize collective self-defense measures. In other words, humanitarian intervention for Ukraine and to help Ukraine to fight Russia in Ukrainian territory and to restore its territorial integrity and maintain sovereignty of Ukraine.
So, in other words, send in UN peacekeepers.
Well, that would have to be a decision by General Assembly, whether it would be the United Nations UN peacekeepers or whether it would be countries who would volunteer support for self-defense for Ukraine, because the rhetoric on fighting the war with Russia shouldn't just go down to the NATO versus Russia. Russian Federation breached and destroyed all pillars and the architecture of the political and international order, and it totally perverted the concept of self-determination.
Given that, and given what's happening, do you think that it's time to reevaluate the post-war international order as it is codified in the United Nations?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is the point of no return for the United Nations. Basically, it came down to the choice whether the United Nations stands up to its moral obligation and reforms itself, or whether it will be sinking boat.
And if we could just shift a little bit, I want to know how you're doing. You have family in Ukraine. You're from there. Your family, I understand, is in Lviv, which is a fairly safe place to be right now. So how are they doing? How are you doing?
Well, my family, thank you for asking. My family is doing okay. All my family is there. My parents, my brother, his wife, my niece and my nephew, all my family and my friends. And they are doing fine, and they are doing what they can do to help the situation. And everybody is doing what we have never thought even that we will have to do. Everybody is doing volunteer work and helping refugees and helping to transport people through the border with Poland and helping to transport the goods. And I have a lot of friends in Kyiv and in Kharkiv, and it's a terrible situation. It's devastating. And here I would like to take a chance to thank American friends and American nation for this overwhelming support of Ukrainian people.
How can we help more if we are so moved hearing you? What is the best way, do you think?
Well, I think that we should communicate to our government to step in to help Ukraine militarily. And this is, again, this is unprecedented situation. We have never had this scale of destruction just in 13 days. Today is the 13th day of the war. And we've never had such an open confrontation with a nuclear power. So everything is unprecedented, and everything requires us to go beyond the limits.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, and hopefully we'll talk again soon. Take care of yourself.
Thank you. Thank you. And you have a great day, and God bless you.
That was Irina Zavruka. She's an adjunct law professor at Southwestern Law School here in LA. She's also Ukrainian and the former dean of the law school at Ukraine's National University in her hometown of Lviv. Coming up, the next phase in fighting COVID therapeutics, how President Biden's test to treat plan is expected to work. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. COVID cases in the United States are down by half in the past 2 weeks. Hawaii is now the only state that still has an indoor mask mandate. Now, a new COVID program from the Biden administration goes into effect this week. It's called Test to Treat. And the idea is if you have COVID symptoms, you can go to a pharmacy, get a rapid, and if you're positive, you're given antiviral pills to take at home. These pills are very effective in preventing serious symptoms. And the whole thing is free. There's a hitch, though. There aren't enough of these drugs on the market yet. Joining us to talk about all this is Cheryl Gay Stolberg. She covers health policy for the New York Times. Welcome back, Cheryl.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. And how many pharmacies are participating in this Test to Treat program?
So I talked to the White House about this morning. There will be 1,000 pharmacies around the country, and the program is rolling out even as we speak. Pharmacies started ordering drugs, Paxlovid, the Pfizer antiviral drug, from the administration yesterday, and I gather these drugs will be distributed to patients as soon as they get shipped and arrive at their destinations.
Wow. Do you need a prescription from your doctor, though?
You do need a prescription. And the idea is that you would go to a pharmacy that has some kind of a, you know, clinic, an urgent care type clinic, like CVS has these minute clinics, and I think Walgreens has some clinics, and you would take a test there, and then you would be administered, or you would get the drug, you know, after them prescribing it to you. So you need a doctor.
So they would prescribe it in-house. You wouldn't need
right,
to get
exactly.
it from your own private doctor.
Okay. Exactly.
All right. So that sounds great. And the idea is that you take these drugs within 5 days of symptoms, correct?
Correct. And that's why this test to treat is so important, because you really need to get to patients quickly after they have been identified as having the coronavirus in order for these drugs to do any good. So you need to test and get the drugs right away. Certainly within 5 days, but the sooner the better.
And then what is the course of treatment?
So it's kind of a complicated course of treatment. Paxlovid is a packaged medication. It's a combination of two antiviral drugs, and it requires a lot of pills. They are three pills taken together twice a day for 5 days. So that's 30 pills in all.
Oh, so six pills a day you're taking.
Six pills a day total, you know, in two separate times, beginning and the end of the day. And yeah, all told 30 pills. That's kind of a lot.
Yeah, but it's really effective, right?
Yeah, it is. It is effective at preventing severe disease. And it's been authorized by the FDA for high risk Americans. And that's important because, as you said, there's not enough to go around. So the goal is to get it to people who are the most vulnerable to COVID-19, older people, maybe cancer patients, people with immune systems who might get really sick from the virus. But I should add that there's also, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, so that means if you're not one of these people, you don't get the drug if you're positive?
That means if you're not one of these people, you are less likely to get the drug and you're less likely to need it,
right.
Especially if you're vaccinated. The dominant variant right now is still the Omicron variant. People who are vaccinated tend to have milder cases if they have no underlying conditions or other exacerbating factors. Although I will say that the definition of high risk is actually pretty broad. Like it includes people who are obese, people with diabetes, et cetera. So I suppose if there really were enough to go around, it would be easier to get. And in fact, the White House tells me that there will be more to go around. In March, they're expecting to distribute 1 million doses. By April, they're expecting 2.5 million doses. So the numbers are increasing.
Well, is the ideal to have this drug available in everyone's medicine cabinet just in case? So you could take a home test. You wouldn't have to go to the pharmacy.
You know, I suppose I think that there could be a legitimate debate about whether or not that would be a good use of resources and money. You know, these medicines aren't cheap. The government is paying for them. There are 330 million Americans. I'm not sure that the taxpayers, especially those, you know, fiscal conservatives, I'm thinking of some of the Republicans in Congress, would really be willing to foot that kind of bill. And frankly, is it really necessary?
Yeah. Well, as is, how much is this program going to cost?
That is a good question to which I actually do not have an answer. You have stumped the journalist. I'm sorry. The administration, I will say that the administration has put in a request to Congress for an additional $22.5 billion to fight the pandemic. And that includes money for drugs and therapeutics and vaccines in this country and also overseas. I don't know how much this particular test to treat program is going to cost.
Well, meanwhile, there's this other drug called Evusheld, and that is for immunocompromised people. It's not a therapeutic. You take it before you get sick, and it's for people who can't take the vaccine. The vaccine doesn't work for them. So is that available now, readily available for people who need it?
So that's a very complicated story, and one that I and my colleague Amanda Morris wrote about on the front page of the Sunday New York Times. Evusheld, as you mentioned, is for people who are immunocompromised who either don't produce antibodies in response to the vaccine or who cannot get vaccinated at all. It is an injection. It's a monoclonal antibody drug. And it is in limited supply, yet curiously, the limited supply that we have is not really being used. The Biden administration has purchased 1.7 million doses. That's enough for 850,000 people to get a full regimen. It has already distributed somewhere around 375,000 of those doses, and only 80% of them are actually sitting on shelves unused. Only about 20% have been used. There's a lot of confusion around this drug. There's a lack of knowledge on the part of both patients and doctors. Some patients are driving, you know, 5 hours just to get a dose. Other patients in other states say they have no problem getting one. So it's been a very confusing and messy rollout, which the administration is trying to address.
Well, Cheryl, thanks for coming on today. Great talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Cheryl Gay Stolberg. She covers health policy for the New York Times. Well, coming up, when Jerry Buss bought the Lakers, there wasn't a lot of glamour at the games.
Sweaty guys in a gym and gamblers, and it wasn't the kind of event you took your family to. And he decided that there was a union to be made between entertainment with sports.
Max Borenstein, the showrunner of the new HBO series about the Lakers, Winning Time, is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Amid the hype and hoopla of the Rams Super Bowl win a few weeks ago, the Dodgers and Lakers both winning championships in 2020, it is a good time to be a sports fan in Los Angeles. Even so, it doesn't really hold a candle to the 1980s.
3-on-2, fast break. They're going to go to Kareem again. Saves it from Magic Johnson. This is played by James Worthy.
So the final celebration belongs here.
Getting ready to pop the clutch.
Well, that jubilation in the Forum came after the Lakers won their fourth of five NBA titles in that era. And because it was L.A., In the 80s, the Lakers were known just as much for their flash, flair, and antics off the court. Get ready for the promised land.
It's showtime.
I don't know why basketball can't feel like that.
To me, Dr. Buss, it do.
That's a scene from a new HBO series called Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty. It debuted this past weekend and airs Sunday nights through May. Max Bornstein is a creator, writer, and showrunner, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So your series is called Winning Time, but everyone knows these are the Showtime Lakers. And of course, it's based on a book called Showtime. And I guess that's the only reason you didn't call it Showtime is because it's airing on HBO. Is that correct?
That's certainly a part of it. It would be a little bit of brand confusion.
Right. Okay. So Winning Time, and it was a winning time. Just describe what that era was like for the Lakers, the 80s.
Well, you know, this show starts in 1979 at the moment the Lakers draft Magic Johnson. And it was a moment for the Lakers and for the NBA as a whole that was really not anything like what would happen. It was the NBA was maybe the fourth, fifth, seventh tier sport behind golf in the television ratings. And then the Lakers changed ownership into the hands of Dr. Jerry Buss, and they drafted Magic Johnson, who was this phenom who had played in the college title and won the college title for his Michigan State team against the Indiana State team of Larry Bird. And that was an enormous, epical moment in the history of college sports. And his drafting to the Lakers changed the game.
And why him? Why was he the key, the magic, if you will?
His ability on the floor was unrivaled in terms of being this oversized, tall for his position point guard who had this kinetic ability to pass behind the back of his head. He had eyes on the back of his head. But more than that, Magic Johnson had this movie star charisma about him that most movie stars don't have. And that personality in this city, in Los Angeles, in that moment with an owner like Jerry Buss who knew he wanted to turn sports into entertainment, it was the perfect alchemy.
Well, talk a little bit about Jerry Buss because he is really an outsized character. We first see him in a waterbed with a young topless woman next to him, and he's talking to the camera. And then he's strolling through the Playboy Mansion, which is behind him. You see a bunch of naked women. So is that the kind of life he led?
He did. He led it very famously. He was a playboy of that era, a man of his era, and very much famously known to be that. It was, you know, a different time. And there are articles of the time talking about, you know, his nightlife. At the same time, he was an entrepreneur and he was a family man, and he raised Jeannie and her brothers and was deeply, deeply committed to his family and to building the Lakers dynasty as a family business. And it's one of the few teams, certainly at its level, that still is a family business.
Right. And he does, looking back on it, it does seem like he did have a stroke of genius when he came up with this idea. Just describe the before and after, before Buss, after Buss, and how he changed the sport.
Well, I think his insight was, as a sports fan and as a fan and a lover of Hollywood and everything, the aspirational quality of everything that LA represented to him, a guy who came from the breadlines in Wyoming, freezing cold, came to Hollywood and to the sunshine and the glamour. He was in love with every aspect of that experience. And he, I think, knew that that was a wish fulfillment. That was an aspirational thing for fans. And he combined this sport, which at the time was, you know, sweaty guys in a gym. And, you know, many of the fans were not even fans so much as, you know, there were sports fans and gamblers, and it wasn't the kind of event you took your family to. And he decided that there was a union to be made between the world of entertainment with sports. And you look at it today, it seems so obvious because you can't go to an athletic event without a big halftime show, even during
the action now, they're playing pop songs and they're, you know, the whole thing is that there's a light show, big introductions. None of that existed prior to Jerry Buss and the people that he employed who brought this vision to life at the forum.
So he had this vision and he needed a star for his vision. And he sees Magic Johnson and he thinks, okay, this is going to be the key, even though he had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar already on the team.
And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was the very best player in the game. But the personality of Magic Johnson was something that no one had ever seen in the NBA and, you know, in any sport. He had a magnetism about him.
A magic, if you will. Well, let me play a clip of tape from a scene where Magic has not been drafted yet, but he and his dad are meeting with Jack Kent Cooke, who owned the team at the time, and Jerry Buss, and as you say, who's about to buy the team, and they're negotiating over Magic's salary should the Lakers draft him. And here's that scene.
I'm thinking $600,000.
Look here, son. Lou Alcindor is the league's biggest star.
Kareem.
Yeah, same difference. He's also one surly son of a bitch negotiator. And we closed at $650,000.
That's why six feels cool. Plus tuition in the summer times, so I can finish my degree in.
Four, and you can work your way through school, young man, just like I did.
Well, I see, Mr. Cook. Basketball is my work, and I'm worth six.
Look here, boy. $400,000 is our final offer.
Mr. Cook, do what you want with your money. Hey, Pop, let's go see some movie stars.
All right, boys. We're all boys here, right? We're gonna think it over. I'll walk you fellas out, right?
And how accurate is that scene?
The sand dab scene. It's an iconic moment. Jeff Perlman writes about it in the book. You know, we obviously got in and recreated it, but it's a famous moment that Magic's talked about where Jack Kent Cooke was not exactly in touch with the young guys that he was recruiting and served him some sand dabs that looked like disgusting old mashed potatoes and told him it was a delicacy and tried to woo him in this way. And Magic came at it strong, having an idea of what he was worth, that it was a very different kind of vibe than what an old-fashioned sports owner like Jeff Kent Cooke was accustomed to.
But also that scene is infused with racism, casual racism on the part of Jack Kent Cooke.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, part of that era. Race is a theme in our country you can't get around, and it doesn't matter how rich or famous or what kind of celebrity you are. It's much deeper embedded in our culture.
Right, absolutely. So tell us about the relationship between Kareem and Magic. Kareem, as you say, was this incredible player and a longtime NBA veteran, a legend already. And here comes this upstart Magic who Jerry Buss wants to be the star of the team. So how did that dynamic play out?
Well, there's these two personalities, you know, they really couldn't be more different on the surface, on the face of it. You know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, as you say, had been a veteran in the league. By that point, he was the most dominant player in the game and had been for years. And there was a sense at the time that he was, you know, if not over the hump of his career, getting there to the point where no one really knew how much longer he would play at that dominant a level. And his connection to the game, at least outwardly, was, you know, somewhat fraught. He didn't love the publicity. He was disillusioned with the press. And in comes this rookie, Magic Johnson, who instantly just had that star power, had become nationally famous because of the game he played against Larry Bird for the college title. And inevitably, there's a spotlight question with any two stars having to share that glow, and not to mention two stars with such different personalities and from such different generations. You know, Kareem was a guy who, and still is, a towering kind of intellectual someone who's deeply interested in activism and serious thoughts and ideas. And Magic, not that he's not that, but Magic was a kid, a 19-year-old kid who was coming in and excited for the LA nightlife. And those two personalities really had, there was obviously going to be some friction, but it's the meshing and the alchemy between those two characters that helped create the Showtime team, which was this mix of flash and glamour and competitive spirit, because they didn't just bring the show, they actually delivered the goods and won rings.
And you actually found an actual college professor to play Kareem, which I find extraordinary.
Dr. Solomon Hughes. He has a doctorate in education policy.
And he's also a former professional basketball player.
He played basketball. Yes, he played basketball for Cal. And he played briefly for the Harlem Globetrotters. He played briefly and professionally. So he has the skills. But more importantly, you know, we were in casting. We had a nationwide search that our casting director, Francine Maisler, who's really the best in the business, was pulling her hair out and saying this is the hardest role she'd ever had to try to cast. Because not only did we know what Kareem looks like and we have to have the likeness, we have to have someone who feels or is 7 feet tall and can play basketball at a high level. But we also, in this show, we're not just putting people out there to be the likenesses of these figures. And so we knew we needed someone who could capture Kareem's spirit and personality, that gravitas. And we were having a real hard time finding anyone to tick all those boxes. And suddenly she calls and she says, well, he's never acted before, but there's this guy. And he has a doctorate in education policy. And he also was a Globetrotter. And Solomon walks in and he, for somebody who had never acted, it was immediately apparent that he had talent. But he's a student. That's what he is, right? And he committed himself to learning how to act. And he's doing, the growth he had over the course of the show and the series, or the season, was just mind-boggling to us. I'm excited for people to see.
And did he meet and talk with the actual Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and get some insight from him?
I don't think he ever has actually met Kareem. But, you know, the great thing about making a show about such public figures, you know, they've told this story in their own words, and Kareem in particular is a brilliant writer. He's told his own story in a number of memoirs and documentaries. So there's great insight that all of our actors were able to get, even when they didn't have a personal relationship with these guys, into who they were and are.
But the Lakers, and including these two former Lakers, did not approve of this project, right? I mean, they didn't endorse it. The Hollywood Reporter says the team, the Buss family, the NBA, even some of the players allegedly detest its very existence. That's a quote from the story. So how come? Why did you reach out to them, and did you want their endorsement of this?
Well, you know, we really felt from the beginning that we wanted to tell as balanced a version of this story as we could. And if we were to involve ourselves with any individual, it would end up becoming their point of view and their version of the story, inevitably. But I do know that on our end, this whole show has been made with such admiration and love for who these people are and everything that they've accomplished, that I hope if and when Magic, Kareem, Jerry West, Jeannie Buss, any of these people decide they want to check it out, I hope they can feel that that's the spirit with which we made it.
There is, of course, the dark side to that, and that is alluded to in the very opening scene of your series, and that is Magic Johnson contracts the HIV virus.
Mm-hmm.
And will you be dealing with that later in the series?
Yeah, you know, there's a reason that we opened the show with that. It's obviously, this show is like a rollicking good time, and it's a window into this era. But in being a window into this era, it's not only a good time. It's also, you know, a lens on that cultural moment. And that cultural moment has its highs and it has its falls. And obviously, in being a show about celebrity and about Magic Johnson's experience, you know, there's excess involved, and anyone who lived through that moment remembers where they were when we heard that Magic Johnson contracted the HIV virus, which at the time, it seemed to be a death sentence. We now know that, of course, thank God, for many people it's not, and he's gone on to have, you know, a massive second act in which he's become an entrepreneur and a businessman and so much more, and an activist. But beginning the show with that, for us kind of announces that, you know, this show is going to have weight to it in addition to the levity and the sort of irreverence that captures the Showtime style.
And I don't know how old you are, but were you watching Laker games in the 80s?
I was a kid, and that was my, you know, my first sports memories were watching Magic and Kareem in the Showtime years. I have vivid memories of going to the Forum the one time, you know, we took one, went for one game as a kid, and I remember my head being, you know, right below the rafters at the very tippy top of the Forum. And so being able to recreate that era and get inside those rooms imaginatively, that as a fan, as a child of the era, I was only, you know, I never really knew, had any idea what might be going on in there. But to be able to access this world and these characters in a personal way has been a dream come true.
Well, Max, thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Madeline.
It's my pleasure. Max Bornstein, creator, writer, and showrunner of the new series Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty. It airs Sunday nights at 9 on HBO through May, and it's streaming on HBO Max. Coming up, MoviePass is back. Will it be successful this time? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Remember MoviePass? Well, way back in the before times, in 2017, the service boasted that for the low, low price of $9.95 a month, you could see a movie a day in any theater in any city. A movie a day. Huh. So movie fans raced to sign up. Of course, the company could not keep up. Phone lines were flooded. Requests for membership cards backed up. The website crashed. And MoviePass, of course, lost money in this whole endeavor. By late 2018, the company faced lawsuits and eventually wound up in bankruptcy. Well, MoviePass is back with a plan to relaunch this summer. And joining us to talk about that is Carla Rodriguez, pop culture writer for Complex. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
I am well, thank you. So, genius or madness, this idea to relaunch MoviePass? What do you think?
I think it's genius. The way we're seeing people are flooding back to the movie theaters, I think it's a great idea. I think people are back and are ready to, you know, to head back to the big screen.
Right. A lot of people are itching to be back out in public. But then a lot of us are saying, you know what? We kind of like watching movies at home. So is it a bit of a gamble?
Yeah, I feel like they definitely have a lot more competition this time around. They said they're relaunching in the summer. Definitely things have changed because of the pandemic, with studios kind of merging with streaming services and releasing the movies both on streaming services and in the movie theaters at the same time, or just going straight to streamers for some movies. So there's a lot now that they have to go up against. But I think people are ready to get out of the house. Personally, I'm ready to get off my couch, you know, and go see a movie. Yeah.
I know. It is exciting. So I'm wondering, though, are they still going to have this low, low price deal, which didn't seem to work very well? What's the plan?
So the founder of MoviePass, Stacy Spikes, he's the one that bought the company out of bankruptcy and is relaunching it. He plans on keeping the same low price. There's definitely going to be different tiers of pricing and whatever, depending on how often you go to the movies. So I think they're going to be a little bit smarter this time around, instead of just offering everybody unlimited movies for just $10. He's going to make sure that, like, this time around, he's going to say, okay, because they started charging $29 to $34, depending on where you lived, depending on your city. Mm. But now AMC, for example, for the Batman, they did a ticket price surge. So now just to see Batman, you were paying $1 or $2 more than any other movie. So it makes sense now for people who are avid moviegoers and they love the movies. And I saw an article of a guy who said that he has already watched 150 movies this year alone. For someone like him, the subscription services, it makes sense.
So, but that price would be higher then for someone who uses it a lot than for someone who uses it maybe once a month.
Yeah. And regardless, I think even if it is higher than $10, if you're paying $18 per ticket for, like, I pay for the Batman, for example, that evens out. I think, if you're smart about it and if you really take advantage of your subscription. And I think the company will see that. Also, they're going to be making it harder for people to just like, okay, instead of like, you could, before people were using their subscriptions, so they said, to buy tickets for other people, or they were sharing passwords like some people do with Netflix. So now I think they're going to be a little bit smarter than that and using other ways to make money.
Still, it'll be cheaper, presumably, to buy a movie pass than to buy individual tickets. Is that the idea?
For sure. Yeah, because I think in the what you pay for a month for the new subscription, depending on what they charge, it's the same as going to the movies twice a month. And then you can really see a movie once a day.
So how do movie theaters feel about this? How do they make money?
It depends. I think they just want to get people through the door, you know, because if you go to a movie, you pay whatever you paid for movie pass, but then you're going and you're buying a popcorn and a soda for $16. That's really how they make their money. It just gets people through the door. Because now if you go to a movie theater because of the pandemic, there's rarely a full theater. It doesn't matter if you're going on Friday, Saturday, they're still right. So they just want to get people in those seats so they can spend money.
Talk a little bit about what happened with the CEO, Stacy Spikes, because he was the original founder, one of them, and then he was kicked out when this tech company came in and took it over. And now he's back, bringing it back to life. So talk about, for a minute, his rise and fall, or his rise, fall, and rise again.
Right. So Stacy Spikes founded the company with Hamid Watt. And when Helius and Matheson came in, they brought in a new CEO, which is Mitchell Lowe, who was at Netflix previously. So they're the ones that made the $99 a month monthly fee a thing, which was obviously, we saw at the end, wasn't the smartest thing. So I announced, I feel like Stacy is like, okay, this is my company. We didn't get enough funding in the beginning. And he had an event last month where he spoke about how diverse founders, when it comes to like tech companies, they don't get as much support financially as other founders do. And he said, this time around, I really hope that people, you know, the movie pass fans who have been going on TikTok saying how much they miss the service, and those are the kind of people he hopes will help keep his company afloat, and it will be on his terms now. He's also in the meantime, where he was away from movie pass, he created another system where now you can build points and credits on your MoviePass app to watch movies by watching ads. So he's working directly with other companies. So like, you watch a commercial before you buy a ticket, and that gives you points, that gives you credits that you can apply towards movie tickets and things like that. So I think he's really trying to find other ways to make money so that he doesn't depend solely on funding and like people investing in his company.
Carla Rodriguez, pop culture writer for Complex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that does it for us today on Press Play. Hey, by the way, happy International Women's Day to everyone, men and women alike. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.